Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 247 for June 20th. How Volkswagen puts power under the hood. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Gary Vasilash.
John, how are you?
Let's do a show.
Why don't we try that?
In fact, why don't we get Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press to join us? Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Oh, I'm sorry, guys. I can't make it. Good to be here. Thank you.
Good magical.
Yes.
And then we've got to introduce our guest, Oliver Schmidt, the General Manager of Engineering and Environment for Powertrain and Fuel Economy at Volkswagen of America. And Oliver, great to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And we should let everybody know you're wearing your Germany shirt. We know whose team you're for in the World Cup.
Yeah, I guess so. I think that's a question of nationality, or?
Yeah, it should be. And look, the experts say Germany should walk away with the cup this year.
I hope they finally make it this year. They have been trying pretty often since 1990.
But Germany's won it three times, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And
54, 74, 90.
I would expect Germans to be able to say those dates.
And I think it's very interesting. When you go to Wolfsburg, there's the stadium with the big VW logo on it, yeah, where football is played, and it's quite a stunning stadium there.
I've been in Wolfsburg when they were still playing the old stadium. The old stadium is still standing, but then when they moved to first Bundesliga, first division, they had to build a new stadium. So you have to meet certain requirements for size of stadium, facilities, everything. So they had to build a new stadium to be able to be eligible for Bundesliga. This is why the new stadium is built there.
And you guys have the naming rights.
Yeah, we are, I think. So I consider those players my colleagues.
So it's perfect that you're here right now today, because Mark's review of the new Golf just came out today. It was published in the Free Press today, right?
It was, and I was blown away by it. It was the best Golf I've ever driven, I thought. I liked just about everything about it. I was especially impressed by the engine, which is one of the reasons that I'm so glad that
And you had Oliver something did. To do with that.
Yeah, basically, I followed this whole Golf. Is before I came to the ES, my role at Volkswagen was the head of powertrain strategy. And I was the one who always had to present to the board all the papers with what do we do for the U.S. So this was the time the first greenhouse regulation came out. So we had to do something to meet greenhouse gas 1 regulations. So then we decided to downsize our engines. And you mentioned it gladly in your article that we got rid of the 2.5-liter 5-cylinder and went down to a 1.8-liter.
So that's the base engine in the new Golf, and
Is that naturally aspirated or
no,
turbo?
No, it's a turbo. Turbo. Yeah. It's a turbo.
170 horsepower,
240. Horsepowers.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's a turbo Volkswagen that does not require premium gas, which I felt like that was a huge breakthrough for the company.
It's the first time we did this, that we did the calibration, especially on regular fuel for the U.S. market.
So in other markets, it requires premium gas?
Other markets, let's look to Germany, which I can compare best. Our worst fuel is better than your best fuel.
Yeah, most markets, there's not regular premium
grade. Why does that not
surprise? There's just gasoline.
We have super plus and super plus plus, basically. That's what you get in Germany at the pump. Mm-hmm. So it starts with 95 octane, 98 octane, and 102. This is what you can get. It's a different measurement, how you measure octane, but that's basically what you get at the pump. And the 95 you get at the German pump equals the 91, 93 you see here in the U.S. Mm-hmm.
And for so long, the Volkswagen turbos were at a disadvantage because of that here, because they got poorer fuel economy and less power using regular fuel than most of their competition did. And you changed that. So you're the guy.
In the past, the turbo engines we had in the U.S. were basically the German engines that we brought over in vehicles. And the 1.8-liter, together with the automatic gearbox in all our base versions of the cars, is especially developed for the U.S. So this is really the first time that a turbo engine was specially developed in this version for the U.S. We took some stuff out of the engine that's available for Europe and other markets, but also we added the regular fuel capability for the U.S. market. Yeah.
So you talk about the powertrain strategy. So does Volkswagen have a set strategy going forward for what's under the hood the same way that it has a strategy in terms of how it'll build the cars with the MQB process?
Yes, of course. But unfortunately, I can't tell you this strategy today. I cannot go on the whiteboard here and just nail it down. No. Honestly, Volkswagen has a clear strategy regarding engines. Our main engines will be four cylinders. Out of those four cylinders, derived three cylinders. In April at the Vienna Engine Symposium, Dr. Neusser, our board member for R&D with Volkswagen, he announced the new three cylinders that Volkswagen is putting out in the European market, which will be launched in the European Polo first. Here in the US, we will not see the three cylinders in a short term. Depending on how stringent greenhouse gas 2 becomes after the midterm review, we might even see them here, but at the moment not. But we have three main engine lines within Volkswagen. It's the 211 engine, which is our small four-cylinder, which at the moment is in the US in the Jetta Hybrid, the 1.4 liter. We have the 888 engine, the Generation 3, which is in the Golf, in the Jetta, in the Passat, in the Beetle as base engine, in the Audi A3 as a base engine. And then we have the 2-liter turbo. Those are the gasoline engines, and for the diesel, we have the four-cylinder diesel, where we are launching the new generation right now at the moment.
Do you see those engines serving Volkswagen's need in the American market as it comes out with more SUVs, CUVs or SUVs? Because to me, that seems to be a big hole in Volkswagen's lineup right now.
Yeah, this is, if you read any quotes of our board members or our new CEO here in the US, you will see that this is identified as the biggest gap. It depends on the size of the car and the customer expectation. So if you look, for example, at the compact SUV segment, you are well served with a 2-liter turbocharged engine. This is even kind of overpowered for this segment. This is what we see currently with our Tiguan. Our Tiguan has a 2-liter turbo engine. And if you do your graphs for comparison and you put horsepower up there, it always sticks out a bit. If you then look at the other segment that's important, the midsize SUV segment, where we announced that we will build one soon, there you see that the 6-cylinder is still dominant. There are competitors out that have four cylinders, whether turbocharged or naturally aspirated, but the installation rates are very low, and at the moment I don't see a significant increase in these installation rates. So it's basically their people doesn't seem to be that conscious for fuel economy. They whether have the solid transportation as a trade-off for fuel economy.
And for American customers, the class that we're talking about now is vehicles the size of a Toyota Highlander or a
Toyota Highlander. Yeah, it's basically what we showcased 1.5 years ago in Detroit as our BSUV or Cross Blue, as we called it. This is the size of vehicle we are talking about.
So you would have a six? Same question.
I was just going to ask, V6 engines within the Volkswagen group.
We have one. It's called the VR6. It's available in the Passat. It's available in the CC. We have a six-cylinder engine, naturally aspirated, available.
And as you move forward with the engine strategy that Gary was asking about, will that remain a Volkswagen responsibility, or will the V6s become more of an Audi responsibility? How does that work?
This depends on platform. If you look at our current lineup, transversal, we have the VR6, that's a Volkswagen responsibility. Longitudinal, we have the V6s, which is an Audi responsibility.
So development of the VR6 continues going forward?
Yeah, of course. Okay. Yeah. Development of the VR6 continues. There are worldwide regulations that this engine has to meet. There are displacement taxes in China, for example. In China, we sell a 3-liter version of this engine because there is a huge jump in the Chinese taxation for displacement. So we have a special 3-liter version of this available there. The engine got switched to direct injection about 5-6 years ago. So there are steps going on this engine, yes.
You mentioned diesel, and in our chat room, Dr. Botox wants to know whether the high-performance diesel is going to come to Volkswagen or just be for Audi for the A3?
The question is, how do you define high-performance diesels? We are launching
GTD. The GTD.
this is a, let's put it this way, this is a discussion that we are having at the moment with everybody involved. Let's put it this way.
Sounds like a big argument between Volkswagen and Audi.
Within Volkswagen, it sounds like.
It's within Volkswagen. Because you mentioned GTD. This is what we see. We see a lot of interest for the GTD. But what we see, what we are afraid of is just taking GTI customers away. Mm. So the GTI and GTD, they are comparing head to head. So the one has the kilowatt numbers. The one has 162 kilowatts in Germany. The other one has 140. But torque, the GTD is a bit better low-end torque. So drivability, unless you are really going fast, is nearly the same. So this is the thing. Do I take out of my GTI customers some away or not? So this is what we have to determine. But we are looking, let's put it this way, like Michael Horn always say, we are looking strongly into this case.
Mm-hmm. So when Americans think about diesels, they shouldn't think of the GTD as a better TDI. It's a completely different
sort of engine. It's a GTI with a diesel engine.
Yeah.
It's not
a fuel economy play. It's a power play.
It's a combination of both. You basically get you get nearly the power of a GTI with nearly the fuel economy of the 150 horsepower diesel. This is how I would phrase this.
Having driven them both, I think the GTD needs to come.
Yeah, but let's talk volume. What would be your volume prediction? We are selling in a good year about 20,000 GTIs. So what would be your volume prediction?
I think it'd be plus business.
Yeah, but how much?
Well, you're already building them, so you've already paid for them. So,
yeah, but we don't build them for American emissions.
That's true.
American emissions is different than European
emissions.
They are.
In fact, I wanted to ask you about that because
what's the number you need to make to break even?
I don't know. I left Germany 2.5 years ago when I was heading this department for the strategy. There I know all these financial figures. But 5,000 is not a number to break even, to put it this way.
Okay.
So
yeah.
This is where you need to. So what's always important when you come up with an engine for a market and with platform strategy, you should always have multiple users of an engine. So if we bring this engine, it should not only be a Golf GTD, there should be other applications of this engine too. Then this makes things feasible.
Oliver, this year Europe is going to Euro 6 emission standards.
Euro 6.1, yes.
Okay, and my...
It's kind of. It's not as bad as the US with phase-ins. We only have a one-year phase-in for one standard. So September 14, all new cars need to meet Euro 6.1. And in September 15, all legacy cars, so cars that have been produced before, need to switch to the new emission regulation.
Okay, but my understanding is Euro 6, or 6.1 as you say, is very close to the U.S. Tier 2 Bin 5.
Yes.
To the point that pretty much the same emission controls have got to be applied both in Europe and the U.S.
Yeah.
Now, when I talk to the suppliers of this equipment, they're saying we're going to have far more volume, which should bring the cost of diesels down
definitely.
In the U.S.
This is about when we met the first time about 2 years ago in Traverse City. I was showing a slide where I showed cost comparison of the current diesel in the U.S. to future diesel in the U.S. And really, because of the big volume that we are purchasing now in aftertreatment systems, we predict costs of the diesel for to manufacture these engines to go down significantly. Because we have this new approach with this modular engine. So basically the long block is the same for all countries.
Right.
If it's Euro 4, 5, 6, 1, 6, 2, left 3, tier 3, long block is always the same. And even the canning for the exhaust system is the same. Only what we put in the canning is different market by market.
Mm-hmm.
So by this, we now have a huge volume. Volkswagen is selling 100,000, roundabout 100,000 four-cylinder diesels in the U.S. It's just a rough number.
That's a pretty big number.
If you go on the internet, you find the detailed numbers.
Okay.
But it's roundabout. We didn't crack the 100,000 last year, but maybe we do it this year. So if you have 100,000. In Europe, we are selling more than 2 million. So there you know where the scales are.
Right.
And if I can combine the 100,000 with the 2 millions, this is when I can achieve right. scales.
So, and that's where my line of questioning was going. Volkswagen's done a pretty good job with diesels in mm-hmm. the U.S., way better than anybody,
Thank
except
you.
Maybe Audi.
Yeah.
And so...
It's the same company.
Will you be able to do something cost-wise to help drive diesel sales even more, do you think?
The question is always to define first the America is always when it what I learned so far is when it comes to shopping cars it's basket. So what's in the basket? So this is what you need to meet. And the question is what's in the basket for a diesel? I'm not a sales guy, so I don't know by my heart the prices for those vehicles. But if I compare, for example, Chevy Cruze diesel to Jetta diesel, price is about similar. They differ in equipment and what you can get on one and you don't get on the other. So they somehow both companies made it that they are not 100% comparable, but they are kind of the same price. So if diesel continues to grow in the US, I think we are competitive with the pricing for the diesels. And as I said, if we get more scales, we can stay competitive for quite a while.
Do you think diesel will grow in the US market?
Yes. Diesel will grow, but it will be a significant grow for our company because, as I said, we sell 100,000 diesels roundabout in this country. For us, it's a huge volume. It's about 20% of our volume. But so for us, it's huge. If it doubles for us, it's tremendous. But for the whole market, this has barely significance. But you see other companies now adopting diesel. We had GM coming out with the Cruze diesel. We had Fiat Chrysler coming out with the Grand Cherokee, now with the Ram. And I think it's only a question of time when they put this engine in more of the vehicles that sit on the same platforms. So there will be a growth in diesel, yes.
Is Volkswagen's strategy more to concentrate on diesels rather than concentrating on, say, hybrid vehicles? I mean, I know you have a hybrid, but you never hear anything about it.
No, we laid this out in several presentations I gave. We have a clear strategy. Diesel is one part of the strategy. The other one is if we talk hybrids, we will mainly focus on plug-in hybrids because we think this is what gives the customer the best value. You can drive on electricity alone, and you can you don't have the range anxiety, and then we will also offer electric vehicles. But our approach to electric vehicles is we want to give the customer what he already knows, but just as in electric vehicles. Both of you have driven the electric Golf with us.
I liked it.
This is our approach for the vehicle. So we take our standard vehicle, we modified the platform in this way that it can adopt any kind of drivetrain you can imagine, and then we can just put this drivetrain in the platform. This is our approach to powertrain diversity. So
we've seen PSA, Peugeot, has come out with some diesel hybrids. Any thought to that? Or what are your thoughts on that?
It's combining two very expensive technologies.
That's what I've always said.
That's my take on this.
Right. Hybrids are expensive and diesels are expensive, and a diesel hybrid is about as expensive a solution as you can come up with.
You can create tremendous fuel economy if you combine the two of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking,
but the one challenge I see with this, especially if I would bring it to this market here, is emissions, because the hybrid always is challenged by emissions. Mm-hmm. Your catalytic converter is always colder than on a non-hybrid vehicle because you run on electricity alone. So to heat up your catalytic converter, you need electricity or fuel. At the moment, everybody is using fuel to heat up his catalytic converter. You need more insulation, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. This is just basic rule. If you take out a hybrid powertrain out of a vehicle and test it without the hybrid, it achieves one emission class better than it does as a hybrid.
Unbelievable.
Because it just needs more heating for the mm-hmm. catalytic converter to get it more efficient. It needs heat insulation. It needs everything like this. If you run a hybrid without electricity, normally it's one step better in emissions.
Didn't the Chevy Volt run into that problem in California early on? They could not get the HOV sticker and they could not get the state's credit. I think for this very reason.
I don't know. I don't know this subject.
And then, they changed it and maybe they are using more fuel through the catalytic converter. But I know early on they had that issue.
sort of in this space, Push to Start wants to know, what's the step after the XL1, the 1 liter car?
What's the step after
the XL.5?
No,
a perpetual motion machine.
I think the step needs to be totally different. The XL1, Ferdinand Piëch always called this our Formula One. This is the Formula One that we are doing at Volkswagen. So, but his one was for the fuel consumption. When the original car was built that he used to drive from Wolfsburg to Hamburg for the supervisory board meeting, the target was 1 liter fuel consumption per 100 kilometers. But this was not a hybrid. This was running pure on the diesel engine. So he always called this our Formula One. I think the challenge of this is to bring the technology of this vehicle to other vehicles, to make this affordable and mainstream. I think this is the challenge of this vehicle. The challenge is of course to develop more fuel efficient technologies, yes, but the bigger challenge is to make it commercially feasible. So this XL1 is a showcase what's possible with fuel economy, and now the step is to bring this technology to other vehicles. Best example for me on the XL1 is the hybrid module that's in the XL1 is the exact same hybrid module that is in the Jetta hybrid. Hmm. The electric motor, the 20 kilowatt electric motor from this one supplier is the same in the XL1 as it is in the Jetta hybrid. So this is the step you need to take. Now you need to dissect this vehicle and then look, what can I bring to others? Other big discussion point, even it's safety, so it's not my topic, but the rear view cameras. So get rid of the mirrors, which significantly increase your drag coefficient, and replace them with cameras. So this car has it, and I know there are discussions here in the US with NHTSA to get rid of rear view mirrors and allow cameras. So this is another step where this car showcases what's possible, and now you can start the discussion with the agencies. I remember we had the same discussions with the XL1s in Europe. I happened to be there when it took place. So they were not denying us certification, but they were questioning it because of the visibility of these cameras. Mm. So in the sunset, we organized a drive with the type approval people from the German TÜV and Kraftfahrtbundesamt, and they were driving through the sunset and tried to check out the visibility through these cameras to be convinced that this system is safe. And we got the approval finally. Mm. But I saw them prepping, and then, no, we need to leave now. The sun is going down. Now it's at this degree. So it was fun.
That's cool. You know, it's interesting. When you see cars without rear view mirrors on the outside, they look naked. I mean, there's something about them. They don't look right.
Shouldn't you be used to it? Every NASCAR looks this way.
Well.
But how often do they look the same way for more than two laps anyway? They're into the wall. Yeah. You mentioned plug-in hybrids will be an area of emphasis for Volkswagen. Two questions. What do you think is the magic number for how long the charge needs to be? How long the battery range needs to be suitable for most people?
If you look at recent studies, the average American travel back and forth to work is 40 miles.
40.
This is the average American travel back and forth to work. So you need to exceed this number. The question is, does the person have the capability to charge at work? One of the advantages we see with the plug-in hybrid, so I go to work, I work 8, 9, 10, 11 hours, depending on what I have to do. I can even charge my plug-in hybrid on a 110-volt outlet, and it's fully charged, and I can drive home on electricity. So somewhere there, I see the magic number. So 20 miles you should meet on the label, because then people can go from home to work on electricity alone.
And what's the window for when Volkswagen expects to have some plug-in hybrids?
We already announced it. It's called the Audi A3 e-tron. It was at the Detroit Auto Show.
Right. But the Volkswagen brand, nothing's been announced yet, right?
Nothing has been announced.
But it's coming because Volkswagen has announced things in China, and it's a global company.
Volkswagen announced what we call the GTE. So we basically, we talked a lot about Golf GTI, GTD. So we are adding a third member to the family. It's called the GTE, which is 1.4 liter, 150 horsepower gasoline engine combined with an 80 kilowatt electric motor. I've driven the car recently. It's amazing.
That's pretty quick, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. I really had my doubts when I sat in the car and drove the car. Amazing. And so this is the third member of the family, and now the decision has to be made, can we bring it to the U.S. or not?
So you were mentioning before when we were talking about GTI and GTD about, you know, the performance of the two and, yeah, and the fuel efficiency. So the GTE, how does that stack up with the other two?
From my experience,
it's the best experience.
Above everything.
Wow.
It was incredible driving this vehicle.
Well,
the only thing is, if you, being German, I focus on top speed somehow. I think the reason is called Autobahn. And so if you're looking at top speed, of course, the GTI is your first choice because that's the fastest one. Then you have the GTD, and then you have the GTE. But as roads get more crowded, we see more and more speed limits, even on German autobahns. There are more and more speed limits. The one that I have, when I travel to Germany, the one I have to take, they now have a speed limit from 6 in the morning to 8 in the night. So wow. Then this time is speed limit, and in the night there's no speed limit. So
like
there are
96 here in town.
So what is the speed limit, by the way?
The speed limit is 130 kilometers per hour. Mm-hmm. This is, if there's a general speed limit, it's normally around the 120, 130 kilometers per hour, which is comparable to your highway speeds here of 70 miles
70, per 75
hour. Miles yeah, 70, per 75 hour. Miles per hour. Everybody is doing 150. Because it depends.
Like here.
Yeah, like here. Everybody's doing 80 miles, 80, 85. If you do 70, you get overtaken all
Mark's
the time.
Mark's 103 miles per hour.
So you've got the GTE and the GTI. And in Germany, the pronunciations of those would be reversed, right? German engineers would be saying the GTE.
GTE and GTE, yeah.
So do people's heads explode when Germans and Americans try to talk about these cars?
No, this is the problem, really, for, I think in general for Germans, is spelling in this country. Every time when I call somebody
at the
helpline and I end up in an Indian call center and they ask me to spell, I most of the time refuse to spell because I always mix up E and I.
Yes.
So now, I would say the GTE,
yeah,
the plug-in, has got to end up in the U.S. market because at some point, Volkswagen has got to generate ZEV credits.
No, ZEV credits are based on group. ZEV credit are not based on brand sales.
Not on brand, right.
So they are based on group.
So the Audi e-tron,
the Audi
will
e-tron
be enough?
Yeah, contributes to our ZEV bank. All Porsches contribute to our ZEV bank.
Right.
So this is decisions that it has to be made in Germany. But at the moment, the clear role is into the ZEV 2 mandate. The Volkswagen is contributing into it with the electric Golf, and Audi is contributing the silver credits that we need with the Audi e-tron. So this is the strategy where we are starting to be compliant, and then when the demands are increasing, then we have to launch more product. Mm-hmm. And then MQB gives us the possibility to just launch the drivetrain in every car we want.
Mm-hmm. Shifting up a little bit, Kurt Maxaguy wants to know, will the forthcoming Golf R finally offer dual-clutch shifting in the U.S.?
There was a Golf R that had dual-clutch shifting, and nobody liked it. So the question is, whom do we need to satisfy? So, yeah, if we bring it with dual clutch, we will get others that will be disappointed by the dual clutch. So this is the dilemma that we are always facing there. Most of the time, it used to be a limited production run. We always did around 5,000. The first generation was manual only. Then we had dual clutch only. Then we had manual clutch. Honestly, I don't know yet how it's coming. But you always have one kind of people complaining. And we talked about financial feasibility and volume. If I do two test groups out of it, one with a manual, the other one with a dual clutch gearbox, I have to run double emission durability. I have to run double calibration, and so on and so on. So it's a question: is it financially feasible to split up a volume?
And then if you do it with a diesel, you could just
don't make it complicated.
So you want to have a diesel Golf R?
With a dual clutch.
With a dual clutch. Yeah, all the diesels come with dual clutch.
There you go.
These diesels are all available with dual clutches.
Hey, we've got a phone call here, Ben. Let's bring that in.
Hi, my name is Noah from Silicon Valley. I have a question for your guest. I'm not sure if Volkswagen uses Haldex or clutch servos or hydraulic pressure to control torque biasing, but assuming the ring gears are of similar strength, wouldn't it be possible to have torque bias to the rear just as easily as to the front? And why not offer a software update or a module that would allow that rear bias for us enthusiasts? Thank you. Enjoy the show. Bye.
So he seems to be talking about torque bias front to rear and
More to the rear than to the front.
A switch to allow the default torque to be to the rear rather than to the front in all-wheel drive models.
Yeah, I understand the question. The big problem here, the big limiting factor, is the design of the parts. So if you would basically over-design your gearboxes so that they or your rear differential in this case, if you want to put it to the rear, then you need to design your rear differential that it can handle all the torque. So this would be a design issue.
So it becomes bigger and heavier and more expensive.
Yeah, of course. So it, maybe not more expensive, but at least heavier. At least heavier, and which would be contradictory to try to save weight. So I know that there are aftermarket solutions available that put more torque towards the rear, but the question is always longevity of this. I know there are companies out that modify, we call it the Haldex. It's the Haldex 4 that we have in the rear for all wheel drive transversal cars. Companies are outdoing it. There are cars that would be capable of doing it, like, for example, our off-road vehicles, like the Touareg or the Porsche Cayenne. There, the differentials are designed in a way that they can handle the whole torque on one axle. But the other ones, at the moment, are not designed to handle the whole torque on one axle for a long period of time.
So with the Touareg, say, could it be a software shift, as the questioner was curious about?
It's hydraulic.
So no software fix.
Not
for that one.
Yeah, but
so the other one needs physical thing entirely.
And honestly, why convert an SUV to rear wheel drive? Mm-hmm. I think this is more targeted towards the sports cars, where a traditional sports car used to be rear wheel drive.
Right.
Good. Look, with this, we should probably wrap up this part of the show. But Oliver Schmidt, thanks so much for coming on. It's been a blast talking with you.
Having me. It was fun.
And good luck to Germany in the World Cup until it plays the United States. And then I hope our German coach helps us kick your guys' butts.
Let's see how his apprentice, which is now the German coach, will handle this.
That's great.
Okay.
Well, thanks again. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
And Ben, why don't we take a quick commercial break here and throw out a shout-out to our good friends at Firestone Bridgestone.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go. Hey, everybody, we're back in the studio. We tried to kick Oliver off the show, but he refused to go. So he's going to sit in with us as we go through some of the news of the week, and there's a lot that we can get into here. Before we jump into that, and maybe this goes along with it, we should let everybody know our television program, which will be available on our website as soon as this show is done, and it's on public television stations across the United States and Canada. Anyway, it's about a new reality show called Motor City Masters. And Gene Jennings is one of the judges on this, you know, formerly of Automobile Magazine. Also, Camillo Pardo, who you guys probably know, former Ford designer, did the Ford GT, you know, one of the top designers. He's in there as a contestant. And then one of the other people that we have on our show talking about this is a woman, Darby, who's a 20-year-old who's a student at CCS. So kind of interesting that there's a reality TV show coming. We know some of the contestants and the judges on it.
And the idea of designing cars and the people who do it or want to do it, I mean, I think it's intrinsically going to be interesting to a lot of people as well.
Yeah, and it was interesting, too, because Camillo Pardo, who is like, I mean, this guy's a megastar in design circles.
And also responsible for the YouTube video of his own Ford GT going at 120 miles an hour down I-94 in Detroit,
I think. That's right. That's exactly right.
That
got him in a heap of trouble at the Ford Motor Company. But anyway, even he was saying he was blown away by some of the other contestants on the show. So I think
there's only so many cooking challenge shows that we can have on television.
That's right. Or fashion.
This is a nice change.
Or home improvement shows.
That's right. Yeah.
So if you guys want to know more about what this Motor City Masters reality TV show is going to be like, check out our show, Out of Line This Week, which is all about it. But I just wanted to get that plug in there.
So yesterday, John, we were talking live for those who were watching right after Mary Barra's testimony to the House of Representatives investigative committee. And boy, that wasn't a pretty sight, was it?
It wasn't a pretty sight, but it was a whole lot better than the first time she was there, where she looked like a deer in the headlights, you know, clearly was stonewalling them, not answering their questions, kept saying, oh, we got to wait until this Veloukis investigation is done. Yesterday, it wasn't as bad, but they were not buying her story.
And she had Veloukis with her, Anton Veloukis, the lawyer from Chicago, who used to be
Attorney General or something?
U.S. Attorney. A prosecutor, basically, for the Justice Department. So one would think that he comes in with some level of credibility.
Well, I thought that they treated him deferentially. I thought that they believed this guy, but I don't think they were buying Mary Barra's story.
Right.
And it's appropriate, I think. I mean, I personally think that Barra has handled it very well and that it's a very good report. But anybody who acts like we know that this is the whole story when all we've got so far is the internal report is, you know, deluding themselves. I mean, there will be an official Justice Department report. And if that lines up pretty much with what, you know, the internal report said, in that case, you know, good on you. You did a great job, and let's move on. But you can't pretend that the verdict's in after, you know, just their own report, no matter how good the report seemed.
Yeah. There's, of course, Senate hearings coming up in a couple of weeks' time. I think they're going to be much tougher. You know,
the
Senate's really kind
around,
of the A-team compared to the
right.
House.
Well, and they were brutal the first time. Yeah.
And there's a couple of things that were raised in the Senate hearings the first time that I'm convinced will come up again. The House didn't touch it. But we know for a fact that GM lawyers didn't, you know, alert the top-level executives at the company of what was going on. Why? Who stonewalled that? Who kept that undercover?
And the problem, it seems to be that, yes, it stopped here, but a culture was created that gave them the idea that this information should stop here. It doesn't have to get to anybody above me. And that's the thing that really has to change.
And a second thing is that came out again in the Senate hearings is that GM's legal department did not turn over all documents requested by litigants that were suing the company for defects. Mm. And that's illegal. Or at least Claire McCaskill, the senator from Missouri, you know, she's going to make this a big point. So I think the Senate hearings.
It gets into some finer points of law for sure.
Pardon?
It gets into some finer points of law for sure.
Right. I'm not so sure that Veloukis didn't get most of those documents, though, for his report, because it was like 41 million pages, I think, that they said. That
Whatever the number was.
They received.
It was huge.
And,
right. But what I'm saying is I didn't even know this, there's a legal term that they call scope of request. So a litigant, you know, a plaintiff suing a company says, I want all documents related to this kind of defect. Well, GM turned over most of the documents, but not all of the documents.
But again,
and that's what Claire
McCaskill
was
the question
really ticked
is about,
off
I
about.
Think. I mean, you know, GM would say, no, we turned over everything. And the plaintiff's attorneys would say, no, you kept stuff from us. And wherever the truth is the answer to whether GM is horribly liable or not,
question. Well, they are liable because now those documents have turned up. And it was
if it turns out that they should have been, and again, I don't know because I'm not a lawyer. But I mean, the question will be, when those documents, when we've all seen those documents, is it clear that, yes, they should have been turned over to the plaintiff's attorneys, in which case GM goes directly to jail, does not collect $200, mm-hmm. I think. But that's what lawyers exist for, to debate, should we have turned this over or not?
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting in Representative Murphy, who was the head of the committee, kept emphasizing that, we shouldn't look for malfeasance when there's,
when incompetence will do.
Rampant incompetence. I mean, and that's, I keep getting back to that is what was going on. I mean, I'm sure that there was some individuals that were knowingly covering their asses, but I have a feeling that there was just rampant incompetence that was going on. And then it comes down to a cultural thing. And it was interesting. So I got an email from, I know we all know him, Sandy Munro, and I'd written something about General Motors.
Sandy's been on the show a number of times.
He's been on the show. And so all this talk about culture and changing the culture, and I hope he doesn't mind my quoting from his email to me.
Too late now.
And he says, it has been my experience that a good culture can be corrupted, but once bad, it is as impossible to reverse as trying to return a hard-boiled egg back to its original state. So it seems pretty tough. So I was thinking about that. And so earlier this week, we had... the Camaro on the show last week, right. The Z28, right. And lo and behold, earlier this week, the Z28, among other Camaros, was recalled.
For ignition
switch. And so I was driving, as I mentioned last week, the Camaro SS. Okay, so this was the problem was with, your knee hitting the key fob, because it's a combined fob and key, right? Well, you'd have to have enormous legs, I think, to hit that. But be that as it may, so I was reading the release that GM put out about this, and I was thinking about how they think that they're now enlightened, and so it says, General Motors will recall all current generation Chevrolet Camaros because of a driver's knee can bump the key fob and cause the key to inadvertently move out of the run position with a corresponding reduction or loss of power. The issue, which may primarily affect drivers sitting close to the steering column, was discovered by GM during internal testing following the ignition switch recall earlier this year. Quote, discovering and acting on this issue quickly is an example of the new norm for product safety at GM, said Jeff Boyer, vice president of GM Global Safety. And I was thinking to myself, wow, they're patting themselves on the back for discovering something that is like...
Should have never got through the system.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, so... How do we explain that?
But only in the context of a company where somebody thought the best way to deal with this question before was, let's change the part number and not tell anybody.
Right, true.
So, I mean, they've come a long distance from a bad place.
Change the part and don't change the part number.
Right. That's what I meant to say. Excuse me. You're absolutely right. The engineer gets it right.
Yeah, right. But here's my point is, this year, we're all on the North American Car and Truck of the Year jury, right? So... this year, Corvette got it for car. Silverado got it for truck. And we'll get into this in the next minute. GM did quite well in the J.D. Power and what
sales
else is out there? The Edmunds and the Auto Pacific Awards. Its sales are up more than Ford's or Honda's so far this year. And what I'm getting at is, if I were GM, this is what I would be arguing. Here's the proof that the culture has changed. How can we be doing so well in the marketplace? How can we be coming out with world-class cars if we're just this culture that tries to sweep problems under the rug?
Well, okay, but this would be assuming that there is an immediate market reaction to what's being revealed more and more and more. I mean, there's a story, I don't know if you guys read it in Business Week, written by Tim Higgins and Nick Summers about... General Motors and a guy named Cortland Kelly who continues.
I read that article.
I mean,
good article.
Now, can you imagine after reading that?
Well, give a thumbnail for those who haven't.
Well, so basically, this was a guy who worked at General Motors, and his job was to basically
catch problems.
Catch the problems before vehicles went to dealerships. I mean, that was largely what he did. And he was finding problems. He was finding with the SUVs that there were fasteners that were attaching the, I think it was the...
tie rods.
Well, no, it was the gasoline...
Yeah.
The filler to the pipe and the gas was spilling out. Right. And he says, wow, this is a safety problem. They're like, no, it's not a safety problem.
It was leaking gasoline.
Right.
They tried to sweep it under the rug.
And they did. And he became a whistleblower. And, you know, state of Michigan protects whistleblowers. But what ended up happening was
that... He had to sue the company.
Right. And he was basically...
Sent to Siberia.
Siberia.
They didn't lay him off.
Right.
They sent him to Siberia.
Yep.
And so can somebody who's going to read that article say, you got to buy a new GM car? I mean, I think it's going to be a delayed reaction.
I think in the Detroit Free Press, you had an article about, are recalls becoming normal now? I think the amount of recalls that has recently been issued by every company is somehow diluting this. That's my, from what I see there. I deal on the other side with, I only deal with emission recalls, not safety. Happy about this. But I think there are so many recalls going out at the moment so that the average customer is less impacted by it by now. Hmm. Because it's just another news.
Recall fatigue.
Yeah.
But the percentage of recalled vehicles that are being repaired has remained steady at about 70-75%, which is good. I mean, it seems like people are getting fatigued to the sense of they're not saying, this car was recalled, so it's a piece of junk. I'll never buy that brand because every brand is recalling. Yeah. But you know, the repair work is still getting done, which is, I think, a very important thing to point out.
This differs state by state. There are states that deny you registration if you haven't performed your recalls.
Oh, good.
There are states, for example, California is the hardest. There it's tied into the DMV. So once you go there to renew your registration, they check if your vehicle with this VIN has performed all recalls. If you haven't, you don't get your registration renewed.
Wow.
Good for California.
Yeah, I'd not heard of that before.
But I have to say, though, to get back to your original point, I think it would take a phenomenal amount of gall for anybody in GM this year to say, hey, look, everything's great. I think they should be really shaken to the core and hope that they are doing things
right
now, but not believe it yet.
You're right. But one of the lines of questioning yesterday in the House subcommittee hearings was they're not buying that the culture has changed at all. They're just saying we just don't believe you. And I think that to go from pre-bankruptcy, some okay vehicles, a lot just, you know, they were just checking the box, to the post-bankruptcy where they're cranking out really good stuff, to me is a sign that things have changed.
I'd go with changing.
Changing, okay.
I mean, Mary Barra still has a lot to do, and I thought that was the real strength of her presentation to the employees 10 days ago, that, I mean, she, you know, really didn't pull any punches. We should be embarrassed by this. Our customers deserve better than this from us.
Yeah.
But you know, speaking of recalls, so far this month, there have been 21 recalls. This is all
automakers.
All automakers, not just General Motors.
So that's one every workday.
It's through the 19th. Here's what this one is one of the most bizarre things I've ever read. So this is from the NHTSA website. 61 GM vehicles from 2013, including Buick Encore and Chevrolet Spark models, recalled for improper welding that may cause the passenger front airbag not to deploy. 61? Mm-hmm. How is that possible?
Well, and that, I think, gets to what Oliver was saying, that it's getting really granular, the level of scrutiny that things are being exposed to.
The thing with the recalls, there are even, I don't know what's in the 21, but for example, if you... by accident in your production put a wrong emissions label on your car, you have to officially recall all those cars. So the number 21...
61.
No, 21 recalls.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to look which are really safety-relevant recalls and which are not. And from experience, something like 61 sounds like quality control in production, and you could really determine the VIN range.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things, and you read these things, and they're like, if they were your car, you'd be scared.
My favorite recall, this goes back at least a decade, in Honda's owner manual, to call for like a service number and a telephone number. In the back of the book, you know, if the dealer hadn't done the right thing and everything, here was the number you were supposed to call for the regional whatever it was. It was 1-800 number. It turned out to be a sex number. Sex phone line. And they don't know where it came in. You know, was it at the printing plant? Was it somebody proofing it? Somebody. It was deliberate. And they had to recall them all.
That's hilarious.
So... And the other thing that just came out this week was, as we were alluding to earlier, the J.D. Power, you know, the Edmunds and the Auto Pacific Awards. And what do you guys make of these?
Really interesting numbers. And to get to the point you were making earlier, some very good news for GM, I think. You know, Chevrolet number 6 overall, ahead of most Japanese brands, many luxury brands, a pretty damn tough day for the Japanese industry, too. I mean, Toyota came in below Hyundai. Acura came in well below average. I mean, you know, Nissan and Infiniti.
But what I wonder, do automakers, and we'll get Oliver's input on this in a second, I know. Do automakers, should they even really pay attention to this?
Of course they should, because it's bragging rights. And you know as well as I do that every single one of them bragged.
Right. Oh, yeah,
But here's the thing.
Give it to the marketing department.
Well, yeah. Of course. But I looked at these numbers in a slightly different way, okay? So Porsche came out, okay,
best.
So by far. So it's problems per 100 vehicles. This is what they measure with this, okay? And we can debate whether there's legitimacy to their ruler, but, you know, they have the ruler and they apply it. So I was thinking, okay, so second place is Jaguar, which is 87. Okay, so 74, 87, then it goes to Lexus at 92, Hyundai 94, Toyota 105, so that's top five, and then we'll just throw on Chevy at 106. So
that's
it's one.
One.
So I was thinking, okay, so if I buy a Porsche, it's probably pretty expensive, right? And so I would expect this to be a good car. So I look.
Everybody expects their new car to be pretty good, though.
No, wait a minute.
And they should.
Wait a minute. So I just a little experiment here. So I looked at the number of deliveries last year in the United States that Porsche had, okay? Then I divided that number by 365. So this would be an arbitrary ruler that I'm using to say, okay, this is the number of cars that would be built if they built a car a day, okay? So 42,324 cars. This means that 116 cars are made each and every day by Porsche, right? So it seems to me that if you're building 116 cars, you should probably make them pretty damn good cars, right? So then we go to Jaguar, which, you know, did phenomenally well, but last year they had 16,952. Okay, again, divide by 365, 46 cars per day, okay? Now we'll go to
Toyota, say.
We'll go to Toyota, say. So last year in the United States, they delivered these cars and trucks, 1,962,195 vehicles. Divide that by 365, 5,376.
So it's a day.
So it seems to me that's, and to be fair to Chevy, to your point, 1,947,125 cars. This means that they're just 41 cars behind Toyota, so that would be 5,335 cars. Okay, again, so here are mass manufacturers who are able to rack up really damned impressive numbers. Okay, I think that those numbers are far more important. Oliver's going to tell me why I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong. I would never tell you you're wrong.
You could. these guys do all the time. It doesn't matter.
I'm not the expert. You need to invite Mark Trahan again. But these problems, what we have seen in the past, is really from problems. My car is stalling. My car is not restarting.
Something broke.
My rear window just fell off.
Right.
Is translating more and more to difficult to use.
Right. So the touch screen.
They
admitted that in there.
They said more than half of the problems now are what you're saying, difficult to use, bad voice recognition,
that kind of stuff. So this is something that has nothing to do with the ruler you applied. If I design a system, how to use it?
You only design the system.
It doesn't matter if I buy one.
Okay,
if I buy,
so
if
it's
I produce
bad interface
one.
Design guys who didn't do their jobs
correctly.
That's a good
point. The question is if it's bad interface design or if it's, for example, market-specific tailored or global because people in different countries have different taste. There's things in American cars that I haven't understood until now why people like it. But why do I need big cup holders? You should drive and not drink. But this is just for example. So these are things that you have to consider there as well. And with your production numbers, this is what companies sold in America. But a 911 for Dubai is coming from the same assembly line where the 911 for the US is coming from, and they don't differ where the car is coming from, or Jaguar or all the other companies. So this is, it's a ruler, but a questionable one in my eyes.
I agree totally that it's questionable. So take the difference between Chevrolet and Toyota.
Right.
And it's what, 106 is one?
105 and 106.
One error per 100 cars.
Right. So, and there's the other thing, per 100 cars. So let's divide that number by 100. 105 divided by 100 is 0.05. And the difference for Chevrolet is 0.06. Or the difference between Toyota and Chevrolet is 0.01 defects. I don't believe the J.D. Power system is that granular. I don't think they can measure 0.01 defect difference from one car to another.
But these are reported defects.
Yeah. They just took what the consumers reported and they divided by the number of cars.
It's all about selling data to the car companies.
Sure.
That's what it's about. And so they changed their methodology, to Oliver's point. You go back a decade ago, a defect was something that didn't work. It broke. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something like, I don't like the way where they put this button or where the way this touchscreen. That wasn't it. They had to change their methodology.
Now that we have touchscreens, shouldn't the car companies be held responsible for making them work if they're going to charge customers for them?
This is the IQS. So this measures what people think in the first 90 days of ownership. I'd love to go back to the vehicle dependability survey 3 years later, where people have gotten used to and learned to use this stuff.
I asked Dave Sargent about
that.
He's the J.D. Power guy. Yeah. I asked him that this week, and he said that there is a gap between the two surveys on that exact point right now, that they are changing the vehicle dependability so that it will also reflect those things. And he suspects that the irritation will decline, but because some people will just get sick of trying to use this feature that doesn't work. But
or
you're
learn how to use it.
Because that's
it's brand
possible
new
too.
To them. Look, I I'm not trying to, stand up for Ford here, but everybody criticizes the Sync system. 80% of the cars they sell have got it. And
but it's not Ford, annoying
granular.
Right. It's not Sync people hate. It's my Ford Touch.
Okay,
And that's on most of the cars as well. So your basic point is valid. I just feel bad because Sync is a really good voice recognition system, and it's been tarred with the same brush as that really bad control system.
Mm-hmm. And I should point out the Ford Edge and the MKX both won in their category, so Ford is...
And the MKZ did very well, too, I think, much to the contrary of how I think most of us reviewed it last year. I mean, the people who bought it, were pretty darn fond of that car.
Gary's looking that up.
I got a question, though, because I kind of agree with, I think, your basic point. One of my editors was saying, does the reporting of anything in the first 3 months really matter anymore? Because cars have gotten so much better than they were in the 1980s when this really was a differentiator between one car and another.
I think that's an interesting point. 0.01 difference.
Yes.
But I would answer your editor by basically saying, well, gee, somebody's buying a car in 2014, So that's what they care about.
Okay, that's pretty much what I said.
You know, they don't care about the cars in 1980 because they're buying their car today and they want it to be...
Well, look, in the early days, none of this was even made public. This was... J.D. Power just sold this to the car companies. And the IQS, the initial quality survey, which measures in the first 90 days, was a good way for an automaker to get feedback of their launch. Here's the first 3 months the cars... So that was what the good feedback was. And, you know, I started to stumble onto, I'm not sure I buy these numbers, when I thought, let's go back 10 years ago and see where cars were compared to today. You can get the list, but the numbers don't match up. Because every 4 years or so, J.D. Power changes its methodology, or it changes how it weights different kinds of problems or issues.
We're keeping it fresh. Come on.
Well, yeah.
And things edit. That's what comes on top of
Things like touchscreens didn't exist.
Right, but I mean,
it's an interesting point. It's not the same number.
And
today.
It shouldn't be, because if we were talking about cell phones and we went back 10 years and we talked about, you know, the Amazon Fire that was introduced yesterday.
Let me elaborate a little bit more. Yeah. Not just because I like to hear myself talk, but
there is that.
I caught up with this discrepancy in not being able to compare year to year to year before all this electronic stuff came in. And they were changing their methodology before we got touchscreens or Bluetooth or cell phones or any of that stuff. Because I was making the argument around the year 2000 that if you went back and looked at Toyota's rankings for 1990, everything in the year 2000 was better than Toyota was the decade earlier. And yet a decade earlier, everyone would have said, oh, my God, Toyota's got the best quality ever. And now, 10 years later, everything moved beyond that point. Well,
the survey
wouldn't be that valuable if all of a sudden everyone realized, dang, cars are really good. There's almost no defects.
But you're not competing with a 1990 Camry. Yeah. You're competing with a 2014 Camry. So you need to know how you stand compared to that.
Right. But the point I'm making is that these surveyors have to change their methodology. Because if they don't change it and there's new rankings and new ways of doing things, a car company is going to say, my quality didn't change that much in the last year. I mean, GM overall dropped way down the list. Mm-mm. Why? Because the old Impala went out and the new Impala came in. That's the biggest reason right there.
Yeah, but isn't this...
For the IQS?
But why should I compare last year's numbers to this year's numbers to 20 years ago? Customer expectation has changed so much. And I think IQS is a valuable measure to reflect customer expectation versus your product. And this is what I want to know in the moment. I want to know, and even if I have a car that's running 3, 4, 5 years, I want to know, is it still what the customer expects from me? Or I have one question there. So being German, I play the German card now. Do you know how many percent of buying decisions are influenced by J.D. Power? Are those numbers available?
That's a great question. I've never seen it. I'd love that number.
I would guess that it does not influence. There's been times where an automaker or a model has gone way up the list, and that will bring more people into the showroom. I'm trying to remember a few years back, Hyundai took a big jump. Mm-hmm. It came out with the 100,000-mile warranty thing, and they came out with a good J.D. Power number. And Hyundai at the time said that did bring people into the showrooms. That's the only example that I'm aware of.
There was more. There was also the first American factory at the same time.
There was
where they built
a number
the Sonata.
Of things,
so
right.
they had more things
they
going
had a lot
on
of
at
momentum.
The same time.
Yeah, they did. I suspect it's more to convince people they already made the right decision.
Well, let's challenge J.D. Power then. If you've got a number that shows what percentage of, you know, buying decisions are influenced by how cars rate, we'd love to see it.
Yeah.
Okay, but don't you think that if we go to a Chevy dealer next week that there'll be a thing on the Malibu, you know, highest-ranked mid-sized car in J.D. Power?
Definitely.
So it becomes an advertising claim, if nothing else. And so if
the good thing is everybody wins some survey.
Right.
Yeah.
as long as you're not Fiat. Right. 206 problems per 100. Talking about 1980s figures, that was a number out of the 1980s, the Fiat score. Yeah. Good Lord. Yeah.
Just for it to keep things even, their number would have been 118 cars a day. Just
so they are in the Porsche.
Yeah.
Okay, look, we got to get to the next step of the show. We've got to get to the rapid fire part where we're all going to ask each other questions. And Oliver, you can participate in this too, but Ben, let's let it rip. Gary, why don't you fire away?
All right, and you may want to chime in on this question, okay? So here's my question. So a few weeks ago, John, when we were talking about Formula One racing, and you suggested, correctly I believe, that Mercedes really focused their efforts and energies and technologies and money and blah, 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 blah on this year, and that they were getting their rear ends handed to them by Red Bull Infinity last year and the year before, but it was all going to come down to this year, okay? So that's the premise. Now, will Porsche or Toyota work to develop their LMP1 cars for Le Mans the way that Mercedes developed for Formula One in order to beat Audi?
Yeah, I think they already have. Toyota led the first 14 hours or something like that.
They came in third.
And Porsche was leading thereafter, and they conked out, too.
Yep.
Right. So
yep. I think Le Mans is the balance between durability and speed.
Right.
This year, Audi had the perfect balance between durability and speed. They had failures on their cars, but they were easy to fix because they have been building those cars since 15 years now. And knowing, one of the first things when Dr. Ulrich came in, he said, I want to have a gearbox that I can change in 10 minutes. If you design the next car, 10 minutes, I want to be able to change the gearbox. And this is how the whole car is designed. And this is what others, if they continue their efforts, what they will pick up. This is like Peugeot in Le Mans. It took Peugeot forever, 1 year, then they finally beat Audi.
Yeah, Toyota did better than I think anybody expected until they blew up, basically.
And blowed up real good.
Yes, and next year, I think they're going to finish, and I think they're going to finish strong. And Porsche, they treated this as a durability test. If they were able to finish a quarter of the race, they were going to call it a good day's work, I think. Next year is what they're shooting for.
Okay, Mark, your question.
Mark Fields, he's taking over as CEO of Ford soon. What should be job one? Gary.
Making sure the F-150 launches.
Keep Jim Farley on as your head of marketing.
Excellent. I'll give you a pass on that, unless you feel like answering.
No, I'm passing on.
Yeah. Okay, my turn to ask a question. Will Richard Palmer replace Sergio Marchionne as the CEO of Fiat Chrysler?
No, somebody else will hire him to run their company before Sergio gets ready to leave.
Gary?
I'm not so sure. It might not be someone else like Mike Manley.
Okay, could be.
Who heads up Jeep, in case people don't know who he is.
And just made it to the board.
And since Jeep is doing so wonderfully well compared to other parts of that company, I think that he has a strong hand to play.
Okay, your question.
The Camaro is going to be shown next week in the new Transformers movie. So this is the fourth Transformers movie, and this is the fourth time a Camaro has been in the film, and it is a hero of the film, okay? So according to General Motors, and I quote, the first three movies helped propel Camaro to sales leadership in its segment for the past 4 years. So I want to know from you guys, how much, if any, impact do you think that the Transformer movie had on a car that the least expensive one you can get starts at $23,555, not including destination?
Zero. Zero in the U.S. market. Helps sell some gray market Camaros in China. That's what the movie did for them.
Yeah, minimal. Four or five cars. Yeah, I'll go with four or five cars.
And I hear Ed Welburn's going to be in the next one.
The next Camaro or the next Transformer movie?
The next
movie?
Transformer movie.
What does he turn into?
CIA.
Bob Lutz.
Yeah. Okay, Mark.
What is the best new vehicle you have driven this year? John.
Ooh, geez. Oh, man. What have I liked? Dang it. What have I really, really liked?
It's standing outside, that, John.
That's not what rapid fire is supposed to be, but so I'm going to blurt out this Bentley Continental GT that I'm driving. Right,
Gary?
I did like the Golf E, whatever it's called, not the electric version of the Golf. I thought that was. I thought it was astounding.
And the question was on the tip of my tongue because I just got out of the Golf TSI, which I thought was ridiculously good.
Yeah. But, okay. Thank you all.
No, but, what I thought was really interesting about that car is, as you were saying, that it is basically a Golf that just happens to have an electric powertrain. And you know, I was just driving this thing. It's like, wow, it's like a car. I mean, it's just it's great.
That's our approach to electricity.
Yeah.
Okay, my turn. Will GM pull Bob Ferguson off Cadillac and put someone else in charge before the summer is over?
Bob Ferguson's spending all of his time in Washington dealing with the
the lawmakers. Ostensibly still the head of Cadillac.
Right, but so he's busy, so they ought to have somebody in charge because Cadillac sales are...
Will they put somebody in before the summer's over?
Yes, they will, and the first question he should answer is, where's the new SRX and where is the smaller crossover?
Agreed. Okay, Gary.
So Harley has announced that it is rolling out with Project Livewire, which is an electric motorcycle. Okay, this is Harley electric motorcycle. And now this is a quote from Mark Hans Richter, Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer of Harley. The sound is a distinct part of the thrill. Think fighter jet on aircraft carrier. Project Livewire's unique sound was designed to differentiate it from internal combustion and other electric motorcycles on the market. Is it a good idea for Harley to have an electric motorcycle with or without sound effects?
No, it's not a good idea at all.
Oh, I disagree completely. Yeah. I think it's very important. I think it gives them a chance to drive a stake in the ground with this century's motorcycle.
I would see industry leadership in technology, not with Harley.
But could you, if they do this really well, could this change that?
They tried with the, I think it was called the V-Rod, or?
Yeah.
Where they had Porsche designing an engine and so on. Didn't work.
And it was the most beautiful, the V-Rod in my book was the most beautiful. It failed miserably. I think Harley should do it, not with the Harley brand.
Yeah. That's...
Okay, Mark, yours.
GM's coming out with its midsize pickups this fall. Will they be heroes or zeros? Gary.
Heroes.
In between. In between in the sense that I don't think they're going to be heroes. I don't think they're going to be zeros. I think it's going to be very tough to break the market with that truck. Not the first year.
You've got to be binary, one or the other.
Okay, it's not going to work. It's not going to work within 3 to 5 years.
And I tend to agree. I want them to succeed because I think a smaller pickup's a great thing. But every time a company comes out with a smaller pickup, buyers say, I want a bigger one, please.
Yeah.
No. There are studies that show a lot of Ford customers are leaving the Ford brand because they can't get a Ranger. Not everybody's moving up in an F-150.
And I know you would love to be able to sell the VW Amarok in America. You think you could sell a lot of those here?
No, we don't think we can sell a lot, but the midsize SUV segment has been neglected for years by the major manufacturers. So the GM is the first approach of a fresh new design in that segment. Ford is heavily negotiating to get rid of the chicken tax to bring their new Ranger from Thailand. So... I think and
if
hope,
they do, you get to bring yours in.
Correct. I think and hope it will be a success.
Yeah. I would say that if you take the chicken tax off, the Katie bar the door.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, and I was speaking of Thailand. This little, I was looking at the sales numbers for Thailand. God knows why. I just...
Because you're Gary.
because it's a big market for those
trucks. Yeah.
I mean, but the Thailand market, holy moly, it is completely tanking. I mean, it's vehicle sales are down like 40%.
Yeah, well, they got like damn near a civil war going on there right now.
I mean,
jeez. That's why. Oh, yeah. And all kinds of companies are delaying investment there. But anyway, my turn. Is Volvo making a mistake, getting rid of knobs and buttons and going with a touch screen on the new XC90?
Ask Cadillac.
I would say ask Ford.
Well, look, we've driven the new MKC Lincoln. They put knobs and buttons back on there because people did not like the touch screen. Any thoughts? Not Volvo or Ford in particular, but...
User interfaces.
I have a good friend who's running a company called the Car Lab in Orange, California. And
Eric Noble.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of work with him. And one of his standard phrases when it came to usability of the radio, he always said, speak after me. There should be a knob.
Yeah.
It's my personal opinion on this.
That's great.
So any thoughts, Gary?
On knobs?
Well, are they making a mistake?
Yes.
Okay, good. Your turn. Are you out of questions?
I'm out of questions, but I'll ask one anyway to stick with the racing theme. So will Jimmy Johnson win the championship still again?
Yes.
Yeah. Who else are you going to bet on?
He's that team is awesome.
Yeah.
You got another question, Mark?
No, but I'll come up with one. Europe. Sales have been up for the last several months after a prolonged misery. Will the European market finish the year ahead of last year?
Yes.
Gary?
It's well ahead.
Yes.
Now. It's been up 9 months in a row.
And there was actually, I was looking at those numbers too. And Volkswagen, number one in the European market.
Yes.
But what I thought was interesting, and this is what I was thinking about, we had that little mention of Fiat earlier, and I was astonished to see that not only in the top 10, okay, so this is top 10, so that Fiat is 10th, and in May, its sales were down by 5%. Mm. And that really astonished me. And the difference between Volkswagen sales, 144,000 and change, versus Fiat sales, 54,000 and change.
Yeah,
and they have these grandiose plans for...
Right. And part of the reason, too, just to add detail to it, of course, is the German market was up strong last month. I want to say 6% plus. The Italian market is dead and still sinking, and that's where most of Fiat sales
are. And looking
are.
At those same monthly sales, the thing that shocked me, Volkswagen Group number one by a wide margin, numbers two and three, Renault and Peugeot.
In the other order, Peugeot and Renault.
I couldn't remember which was which, but I was astounded by that.
You're both wrong. It's Ford, Opel,
No, for the month, not the year.
For the month.
No, should be for the year, too.
I got to check the numbers I was looking
for. Ford outsold PSA?
No, yeah. I believe the numbers you're reading off your sheet are correct. I have to look at the ones I saw, because the ones I saw, it was PSA number two, Renault number three. Ford had a terrible month. They were one of the few volume brands that was down.
2.4%.
Yeah. So I'll check my numbers again. I won't.
One of the big things is French market is coming kind of back in Europe. And then the other Southern Europe markets that where we struggled a lot with our Seat brand. Spain and Portugal are stabilizing, I would say. And as you mentioned, Italy at the moment is a mess, and Fiat heavily relies on Italy.
Yep. Okay, I got one more question here, and then we're going to wrap it all up. It's another Volvo question. Will Volvo's customers in the U.S. buy S60s made in China?
Yes, because they won't even know where they're made.
I agree with Mark.
I'll beg to differ. I think one of the real appeals of the Volvo brand is its Scandinavianness.
Have you seen their new commercials? The woman that sounds like Ingrid Bergman saying, "We are Volvo of Sweden." They never played up the Swedish thing before this year, and now they're playing it like it's a heritage.
And they could just say Swedish engineering, like a certain other company is basically making cars in, I don't know.
You could be right.
We make them, yeah. But our engineering is still in Germany.
Right.
They are engineered over. But just look what you have on the table here. Designed in California, made in China, and it works perfect.
That's right.
But they only have designed in California in their boxes. They don't have the made in China part.
It's going to be fun to watch, though, and the S60 is a really interesting car, too.
It's a nice car, and, Volvo is probably the only brand where I'd say where it's made might make a difference. For any other brand, no. We all wondered when Honda first started building cars in America, would Americans buy American-made? Yeah, they will. Same happened when Mercedes and BMW came here. Yeah, Americans would buy
it. But this opens the door for a lot of other companies to do the same thing. I think that's the really interesting thing about Volvo's move. Nobody wanted to be the first, but nobody's going to be hesitant to be the second.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, look, let's wrap it up officially. Oliver, once again, awesome having you here.
Thanks.
You have to leave now.
Yeah. They're going to shut the lights off.
And Mark, great having you here, too.
Thank you
really
so
good.
Much.
And then Gary?
John, I will not see you next week when John Krafcak will be here on the show. I'll be driving a certain car, but...
We'll have fun with Krafcak, I'm sure.
I'm sure you will, too. I'll miss him. Give him my regards.
I'll do that. I want to thank everybody for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.